Welcome to the Unfair Podcast.
Good day, everybody. This is David Marsh of Unfair. It's a great pleasure to introduce two speakers in our podcast today, talking about the concept of money, what it means to the individual, but also what it means to governments and states, and also, I dare say, to the overall psychology of human beings. And I've got two speakers here, both profoundly interested in and expert in this subject. One is Natasha Valla, who is at Sciences Po in Paris. She was previously the Deputy Director General of the European Central Bank, looking after monetary policy. And she's written a new book together with Michel Aglietta called Le Futur de la Monnaie, or The Future of Money is in French, but it'll come out also in an English edition before too long. And Thomas Mayer, who's a very well-known German economist, who is the director of and founder of the Flossbach von Storch Research Institute, which is affiliated to a major fund manager of the same name based in Cologne in Germany that looks after a lot of private wealth and is therefore fundamentally interested in the concept of money for a whole reason that I don't need to explain to you. So, Natasha, you've written this book. What was the aim of the book, and what does the book tell us about the fundamental concept of money and its importance to the human psyche?
The book is really an overview at a specific point in time, which is now, and now is a time when the digital economy is sort of taking over. We are changing our way of life, our way of consuming, a way of saving money, and money is changing its form as well. Money is something, it's an institution, you know, that has been with us ever since the state has appeared. But now the form, the physical form of money is changing with the digitalization of the economy. But there are aspects of money that are fairly permanent, I would like to say. And so maybe if I start with this, we then open the book, you know, to issues related to the institution which is in charge of issuing fiat money and making sure that the link between the currencies we're used to, the currencies that are issued by a sovereign entity through the central banks, the link between those currencies and the citizen, it kept intact, even though a lot of technological evolutions are taking place.
Do you think because of these technological developments and also because of the searing, wrenching changes in the world economy as a result of the pandemic, do you think that this fundamental relationship between the individual human beings who use money and money itself as an instrument of value and a store of reserves, is that relationship changing, do you think?
It is not going to change anytime soon, because it is so deeply rooted in the way we live together. Money is a debt between the entity that is issuing it and yourself as a citizen when accepting it as something of value. And the fact that it is representing a relationship of debt will always be there, you know, however it's, you know, it's whatever technological form or whatever evolution of the economy. So this is fairly permanent. And I would even say, and this is something we explain in the book, that there's a psychoanalytical dimension to money as a unit of account. We speak numbers in our societies. The way to express links among individuals or links between institutions or entities is often accounted for in terms of numbers. So it's very deeply rooted in our sense of being of a common, you know, a unity, and also having links among each other. There's also a dimension of justice in money, in the sense that when you have money unit, or when you have a bill, or you have some monetary quantity on your bank account, you have the feeling that it is worth something, and that this worth is representing either an effort that you have made in the past because you've worked and you've earned your wage, or, you know, something that has been bequeathed to you. So there's this dimension, and this institutional dimension is really something that is going to be there for as long as we are a society in the way we form a society. And there's no, probably very few societies that do not have money as an institution. And even societies that still rely on gifts, there's this exchange dimension, which is represented in quasi-money. So all those dimensions are now confronted with a very, very modern, very, very fast evolution, which is the digitalization.
We will come on to that in a moment. So money is a fundamental part of the human condition. That is clear. Thomas, is this a universal concept, or does it vary from country to country? You come from a country called Germany, which has had a very fluctuating relationship with money over the last couple of centuries. Is there a universal condition of money, or is it specific to individual countries and civilizations?
I think there are two basic concepts of money around. What Natasha just talked about is what I would call the charterlist view of money. In fact, the charterlism goes back to a German economist of the early 20th century, Friedrich Knapp, who says money is what the state defines as money. That's one way of looking at. There's another concept of money, which you can call commodity money. This is the Adam Smith type of money. Money is a means of exchange and a store of value. And money is elected, so to speak, by society. In Smith's times, it was metal money, because Isaac Newton made a miscalculation when he was master of the mint in the UK. The UK moved from the bimetal standard of silver and gold to gold. So there is this way around of money being a commodity used for exchange, not issued by the state. And the other one is obviously, as Natasha said, the charterlist view. Presently, we are in a system where we have what I call the public-private partnership of money production. Our money that we do not sort of hold in hand, so not the banknote, but we have an account, is basically a private liability of the bank to you. It's created if the bank extends credit. The bank puts on the asset side of its account a claim on you, and on the liability side of its account, it puts a liability to you. It creates the money. But it does that under public management by the central bank. And I call this credit money. So money is a very, differentiated concept, and many people don't really understand what they have when they look at their money on account and the banknote in their pocket.
And this issue about national money, we have, after all, in Europe, a denationalized money, don't we? Because we've got one euro, which is shared by 19 countries that use it, which all have 19 different governments. So do we have a different form of money that is now being developed in Europe? A rather odd type of money, a currency with a central bank, but without a state.
Yeah, the euro is a very strange animal right now because, most people would agree that it's incomplete. We have on the one hand the euro issued by the European Central Bank. But the only way we can get this euro as private citizens is in the form of the banknotes that are signed now by Madame Lagarde and previously by Mario Draghi. This euro is of the same credit quality all over the euro area because the banknotes have the same credit quality. It's basically a liability of the European Central Bank. But when we look at our bank accounts, what we have on account, that's very different because this money has been created by the banks for credit extension. And we do not have a full banking union. We do not have a complete deposit insurance scheme at the euro area level. So therefore, what we have when we look at our accounts is basically national monies. They are as good as the credit book of the bank, or more importantly, as good as the deposit insurance of the state in which the bank is located. So the euro is half finished.
Well, you know a lot about this, Natasha, because you did work at the European Central Bank. But I don't want to go too deeply into the whole future of the euro, apart from to go into the digital area, because in your book, you make a very strong plea for currencies to exist also in a digital form. Can money, particularly a digital euro, can that add to the values of Europe, the democratic values, the physical values, the upstanding values of Europe as a whole? Can a digital euro be brought into service, maybe to make the currency more complete in the way that Thomas has been describing?
That's a very good question. I think nothing will replace a single, you know, the completion of the euro in terms of political dimension and fiscal dimension. This being said, the citizen itself, when the euro was introduced, made the euro area a daily, you know, reality of daily life. And this is something that is calling for the evolution of the euro, as we know it, into the digital dimension, in a cutting edge manner. We have now, as European citizens, we all know euro banknotes. We all have euro-denominated bank accounts, and that's a norm. That's our normal today. Now, our lives, and in particular after the pandemics, you know, the pandemics has changed the way we live in a way in which, you know, the digital dimension of our daily lives has gone, you know, has become very pervasive. We buy a lot more through the internet. We use payment systems through our phones. So all those dimensions of us being Europeans, they also need to have a digital expression of the euro. Now, this has implications, very deep implications, because as Thomas was saying, a lot of the euro has been, of the mass of euros that we are using has been created by private entities that are banks. But the single link that every euro area citizen has with the ECB is the actual physical banknote. And what we know, what we've observed in recent times is that whereas European citizens are using the euro banknotes to store wealth as much as in the past, if not more than in the past, in terms of using euros for making payments, this usage has gone down fairly significantly. So it means that slowly, the link, the direct link between the citizen and its central bank is being eroded, at least through the payments usage. And therefore, this calls for this, you know, obsolete, I would say, the sort of payment system, which is the banknote, to be replaced by what is the, you know, state of the art in terms of payments dimension. So I think it comes up as a complement, really, to cash and to deposits. Now, there's also beyond this having access to central bank money. I think it's also a matter of protecting the citizen against risks that are associated with alternative monies that would either be, you know, issued or managed by entities that are not regulated payment institutions, or potentially also by you know, the usage of currencies that are either not sovereign or from other currency areas. So I think for all those reasons, the digital euro, I would turn around your question and say, the digital euro is a necessity, is a necessary condition for European citizens to remain, you know, a part of a single entity and the feeling of belonging to a political entity which is represented today by a currency.
Good, thank you. Thomas, how do you see this? Do you think a digital euro is necessary and maybe even inevitable to make up for these imperfections that you've been talking about in the makeup of the euro right now? And do you think it's actually going to come?
Well, I think it is. It would be a great chance to complete EMU. We are presently stuck because the work on the European Deposit Insurance Scheme is politically enormously difficult because people associate it with communitizing banking risk across the euro area, and therefore we don't get further on this. This is why the non-cash money, the bank money, is still national, because it's nationally backed. A digital euro would actually overcome this. Let's for a moment recollect why came banks into existence. Because they facilitated payment. When people were carrying around gold and silver and whatever, in some countries it was even iron. The Chinese had iron money, which is very heavy. The banks took the role of warehousing this heavy money and issuing then notes against it, bank notes, paper money in China first, and later on as of the 17th century in Europe, much easier to carry around. And then came the electronic money of the banks that could be transferred across long distances, whereas the paper banknotes of the central banks could, of course, only be handed from person to person, and it was very imperfect to send them by mail. Now, with the digital central bank currency, we have the possibility to send the banknotes electronically over longer distances from person to person. So, in a sense, we can create a unique and unified European currency of the same quality everywhere without going through the banks. So from that point of view, you could do away with all the debate about European deposit insurance or whatever. You would have a safe money in Europe. But of course, this would also have important consequences for the banks.
Do you think, Thomas, that this leap forward, the missing link, you might say, is going to happen? Because surely it does require the same kind of effort of political will as would be needed to bring in, say, a deposit insurance in a uniform way across the union. Surely you can't bring in a digital euro in the way that you're doing to create this completeness without a significant amount of political will by all the different union governments together.
Quite frankly, I don't know, David. Both issues are very thorny. The deposit insurance we already talked about. The digital euro would change the banking sector. It would, some people call it disintermediation. It would disintermediate the banking sector. The banks would have to find a new role. They would, as the textbooks still explain it sometimes, they would have to collect, take on deposits of the digital euro and then lend them on and not create money through credit extension. I don't know whether we are ready for the one or for the other way forward. But one thing is sure, if we don't go forward either with the digital central bank currency or with European deposit insurance, then the euro remains half-baked.
In terms of the international dimension, Natasha, you point out in your book the way that China is forging ahead. Is there a danger, just to take forward what Thomas has just been saying, that not only will the euro be half-baked, but it will be squeezed between a potentially digital dollar and a digital yuan, and the half-bakedness, the lack of completion of the euro, will actually hold back something very considerable, which will be, shall we say, European sovereignty, European power, and more significantly, European living standards. Europeans may be poorer without a fully digital euro. Would you go that far to support that thesis?
Yes, I think, you know, this is an evolution which has no midway. The emergence of central bank digital currencies around the world is really dictating the way in which every central bank has to move forward. Currently, there's no strategic focus on promoting the international role of the euro or making the international role of the euro an objective for the European Commission or for the ECB. But even though that's not the case, I think as the usage of currencies that have a digital form becomes more and more pervasive, if there's no option for making, you know, this usage in euro, but there are alternative options, then a rational choice for, you know, international payments, even for the usage of citizens, will be to move to other currencies. So I think strategically, there's no other choice than moving all together, potentially at the same pace, in the same direction. And this brings in, I think, a whole, new geopolitical dimension to digital currencies, really, which is the architecture of the international monetary system. When you look at how things are today, and when I say today, I have in mind a world where there's no generalized network of central bank digital currencies, then there's a missing piece in the international architecture. We have, half a century ago, we have created the SDR. The IMF has created a sort of synthetic currency, but that has never been really used, that has just remained a virtuality for the sake of usage within the IMF system. But this is really a missing piece. So currencies today don't speak to each other except through foreign exchange markets. And foreign exchange markets may be very efficient at the wholesale level, but they are extremely inefficient at the retail level. And this has a very concrete impact on the daily lives of citizens. They have to pay huge margins when they want to convert, one currency into another.
Could you put this into this international geopolitical context that Natasha is doing as well? What are the risks for Europe if it doesn't go ahead with the digital euro?
Yeah, I think I would answer this question by asking the question, what would have happened if, when paper money was introduced, one country would say, I do not allow paper money in my jurisdiction. There will only be the metal money around. I think people would have adopted other nations' paper money from elsewhere, and use that to facilitate transactions. So if the ECB doesn't move along, I think we will be paying with other digital currencies, private digital currencies, so-called stable coins. Right now, it seems to me the ECB is much too timid. They may allow a wholesale central bank digital currency, which means that in financial institutions, banks and so forth can exchange payments with each other with that currency. But they're very timid as far as the digital currency for the citizens are concerned. Presently, plans are that one would be able to use only a very limited amount, let's say 3,000 euro per wallet of the digital currency. If that's the case, if they go along this line, then we would probably use substitutes, money substitutes that big companies, American platform companies, will produce for us.
Yes, so there's a real battle going on. There can't be all that much time here as well, or is there time? Because people are not going to start using the digital dollar or the digital yuan straight away, are they, Natasha? Let's give you the last word. When do you think the digital euro will actually arrive, both retail and wholesale? The retail is very important. And also, what would you do if you were still at the ECB? Let's say you were Madame Lagarde. What would you do to drive on this process?
Well, I think the ECB is treading on tiptoes at the moment, and it has many other things to deal with, so we may give them an excuse. But I think the pace will be dictated by not only by other major currencies and major central banks, but also by developments in the private sector. There's one dimension that we did not mention so far in our discussion is who is issuing the currency and whether it's an entity that is sovereign and public, or an entity that is private and therefore, in a form that is less, that has a link with credibility and with trust that is a lot more relative. So I would say the pace will be dictated by evolutions in payment systems in the private sector, and this is going very fast. So, a few months ago, I would have said maybe we'll have to wait 5 years before the digital euro comes. But to me now, 5 years seems to be a sort of higher bound to the time in which the digital euro will see life. I think it can be fairly fast. There are processes to be respected, and in particular democratic processes. It has to go through, the parliament. There needs to be discussions to be held on this. But, as as far as this is not holding back the process too much, I think this will speed up in the coming couple of years.
And my question to you, what would you do if you were Madame Lagarde once you've got this strategy review out of the way, once you've resolved the issues connected with the pandemic? If you were Madame Lagarde with another 6 years left to your mandate, what would you do to drive on the digital euro, Natasha?
I'm very sure that she has lots of ideas and that she knows how to pace it when the short-term hurdles are out of the way. But I think, you know, cooperating with other central banks, thinking about how to construct a network, you know, interoperability of central bank digital currencies, that should be done as a cooperative game. And therefore, within, you know, within the networks offered by the BIS and in good intelligence, as we would say in France, I would do that hand in hand with, you know, with the Fed and with the Bank of England and with other central banks that that have the same appetite and make this happen as soon as possible. Not, you know, not in a full scale, maybe, but as a concrete possibility that can be activated very quickly if and when needed.
Yes, well, of course there is a network, isn't there? There is a group chaired by Benoît Cœuré, who you know very well, and John Cunliffe at the Bank of England, of these major central banks, including the ECB. I think they could speed up a bit, and I think they could be driven somewhat more, perhaps, by private sector imperatives. But I'd like to thank you both very much indeed. This won't be the last time that we've hearing from you both, I'm sure, Thomas Meyer of the Vosbach von Storch Research Institute in Cologne, and Natasha Valler, who's the Dean of the Sciences Po School of Innovation and Management in Paris, and who's just written the book, Le Futur de la Monnaie, with Michel Aglietta, shortly to come out in English as well. Thank you very much indeed for your time and giving us a fascinating review of this subject, which is not just monetary, but geopolitical as well. So this is David Marsh saying goodbye, everybody. Thank you for listening, and do tune in to the next podcast.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.